Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
We hear this man's voice a lot on the radio.
Yeah, boy. Lovely. Lovely job, Oscar. Great afternoon. Fantastic.
He's a former Olympic silver medalist. And now he's hoisting aloft a trophy that means that McLaren lead the rest of the constructors in the pinnacle of motorsport.
On the podium with McLaren and Oscar, I felt very conscious of the number of people in the team who've worked towards that. So I felt really proud to kind of represent that group of people up there.
In rowing, Tom Stallard won Olympic silver and World Championship gold. In Formula One, he's won multiple Grand Prix as an engineer with Jenson Button, Daniel Ricciardo, and now Oscar Piastri. In both sports, teamwork has been essential to his success.
One of the nice things about rowing is that you can't play your weakest person out of the game. If one person checks out, then it's game over. So you're only really as good as your weakest man. To be honest, my favourite bit about rowing was the teamwork and working together. And I think that building strong teams was one of my strengths in rowing. And I think that generally speaking, that's been the case at McLaren as well.
Tom knows exactly what it takes to win at the highest level of professional sport. So does he think Piastri is a future F1 world champion?
For a driver to be world champion, they also need to be a leader within the team. His kind of down-to-earth but still humorous attitude is well received in the team. He makes time for people. He knows a huge number of people in the team by name and knows like personal details about them. That is quite galvanizing. It makes people kind of genuinely get behind him and move heaven and earth to support him.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. As a professional rower, Tom Stallard won silver in the men's eight for Team GB at the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games and gold in the Cox 4 at the 2002 World Championships in Seville. Then just months after his Olympic silver, Tom joined McLaren as an engineer. So why did he make such a huge career change? And how does life in Formula One compare to rowing? Tom gives me the answers to all of this. And he talks through his grueling fitness regime as a rower and how his peak physical condition back then compares to an F1 driver's today. He explains the role of race engineer. He gives insights into how his relationship with Oscar Piastri works and what his other responsibilities entail as McLaren's Director of Human Performance. Plus, you'll hear insight into how Jenson Button excelled in changeable conditions, why Daniel Ricciardo struggled at McLaren, and what Williams can expect from Tom's former driver, Carlos Sainz, in 2025. Tom also tells me why Piastri has established himself as a serious frontrunner so early in his F1 career, how he'll cope if given team orders, and what it will take for the Australian to become world champion in the future. Tom's articulate, he's motivational, and he knows racing inside out. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Tom, it's lovely to have you on the show. How are things?
Very good, actually. Very good.
I love coming to the MTC because I feel like I'm in some kind of Bond lair.
Yeah, it's Bond lair, space base, Mars colony.
Does this place ever get old? I mean, I remember when it was open back in 2003 with Ron Dennis, and coming here now, seeing the old cars, seeing all the trophies. Do you find it motivational coming to work?
I do, because although the building, it does get old, I think it needs a lot more maintenance now than it did when it was new. But still, yesterday was the team, friends and family day, and they opened up the boulevard at the front of the building to team members, but also their families. And whenever you see someone who's not been before walk into that space, everything is written on their face. You can see how impressive it is. And it's this incredible reminder of how lucky we are to work in somewhere that is so inspirational.
And I guess the mood at the Friends and Family Day must have been phenomenal, because the team is having a great season. Your driver, Oscar Piastri's taken, what is it, 7 podiums, couple of victories. What's it like riding this particular wave?
This period feels very built within the team. There's a great sense of camaraderie or even family within the team. I think that people have a phenomenal amount of trust in the leadership of the team now, and that the leadership of the team genuinely care about the people who work here. So that is very powerful. It makes it a very positive place to work. I mean, to be honest, the good results that are coming at the moment feel like they've been built from that. You know, to some extent, we are, I hesitate to say surprised, but pleased that the results are coming at the rate that they're coming at. We knew we were developing something really powerful and building something really strong in this team. But over the last 18 months or so, then that has really started to build a momentum, which now is visible from the outside, where internally it had been creating and building for a couple of years, but we'd not really had the sort of breakthrough that was visible perhaps to the media or the fans.
Are you able to enjoy this moment, or do you as a team live in fear of losing the edge?
I don't think we do. I think at the moment we feel very much like we're still in a developmental phase, that the team is still growing and building, and that the things we've been working on, they're not yet ready. The truth is, the reason why we're, if anything, surprised that these good results are coming is because we feel like there's a lot of good processes that we're still working on and developing. So there's still a lot of opportunity. So if anything, I think we are keen to show the world what we're capable of, because we don't think this is it.
So this must give McLaren fans a lot of confidence for 2026 and beyond.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's 2026, obviously a big change of regulations. We're approaching that head on. I think the team is approaching that with confidence, but equally a big change in regulations always introduces some element of risk, let's say, some reshuffling of the pecking order. And so when you're not doing well, you can see that as an opportunity. The truth is, when you're doing well, if that's coming from having good people working in effective ways and collaborating well, that should help when you approach a new set of regulations. And I hope that we'll be able to come out of that with a positive.
It does make me wonder about priorities, right? The team is sitting pretty at the top of the Constructors' Championship now, 2024. If you're in a similar position next year, 2025, will you in any way compromise 26 just to win another championship in 25?
I mean, I think, as I say, this team is, we're here for the long term. McLaren, as you know, has been around quite a long time now. And in fact, we won our first championship 50 years ago. So we're celebrating that at the moment. This is about building a long-term vision. I don't think we can afford to fall completely behind on 2026. So as soon as we get to January and the opportunity comes to start working on the 2026 car, then I'm sure all Formula One teams will start to move a lot of focus onto that. And if we think that it's okay just to focus entirely on 25, you'll just get left behind in 26.
Tom, can we talk a little bit more about success and performance? Because you've spent all of your adult life in sport. So first up, how does the success you're having now in Formula One with McLaren, with Oscar Piastri, compare to the success that you had as a rower? What gives you more pleasure?
That's not really a comparison that I make. When I was rowing, I loved rowing. I still love rowing. My whole life was dedicated to that. And the successes that came from that were brilliant. You put everything on the line for those. And then I to be honest, got tired of that level of training that I had to do, of permanently being knackered. And so I decided I wanted to do something else. And you can't keep rowing forever. I'm 46 now. You can't be still in the Olympic rowing team when you're 46. So I worked out that I'd like to move to Formula One. And I was very lucky to be able to make that switch. And now I dedicate everything to trying to win stuff in Formula One. So in many ways, in that regard, it's very similar. It's a different kind of effort in some way, but it's very similar in terms of dedication. And so the successes in that way are quite comparable.
Let's take it back to Baku. You're on the podium. And did you get a similar buzz up there that you did when you, I don't know, won the boat race or world championships as a rower?
Yes, very much so. Very, very similar to, you know, in many ways to the Olympic podium. On the podium with McLaren and Oscar, I felt very conscious of the number of people in the team who've worked towards that and who, if you like, could have been on the podium with me or even instead of me. So I felt really proud to kind of represent that group of people up there. I hope that in the champagne battle that ensued, I did a reasonable job of living up to that.
You certainly did, seem to remember. But look, it does raise the question, right? Formula One is both human and mechanical. So how difficult is it to get all of the different elements, the car, the driver, the team, to peak at the same time?
Do you know, the longer I've been in Formula One, the more you become aware that it's way more human than you think. Like, of those three things, the human bit is the, I mean, I guess the drivers are human as well, believe it or not, but the human bit is where it happens. And the humans develop the machine, and it comes from the kind of collaboration between them. One of the things you see a lot, like, you know, a pub quiz team is a good example. Sometimes it's better to be in a pub quiz team of one because you know the answer. England won the World Cup in 66, so you just write down 66. And actually, it doesn't help to have someone saying, I think it might have been 1970. So the big challenge is, how do you get more people to produce a better result rather than more people to just spend a lot of time debating nonsense and actually quite often landing up with a worse result or a more confusing picture? So what Formula One is about is how you benefit from the magnitude of the resource you have and create that kind of situation where everyone is thinking enough in the same direction that you're not pulling each other apart, but still there's space for fresh ideas and inputs.
Well, I want to talk to you about being, you know, Oscar Piastri's senior race engineer, but can we just park that for a minute? Because you have another job here at McLaren, which is the Director of Human Performance. What does that mean?
So for us, when we talk about human performance, that's really across the, let's say, 800 people in the team. It's not just the driver human performance. It's not even just the pit crew human performance. It's how do we optimize the human performance of everybody in the team, and that includes people in the aerodynamics department or the machine shop. The role is very broad, and the idea is to bring some of the elite athlete mindset that I have, having been a rower, to the way that everybody approaches their role within the team.
Is that just physical fitness, or are you working mentally as well?
No, a lot of it is around mental fitness as well. The two are obviously acutely linked. One of the things I learned when I was rowing is that pretty much every time that I got ill, the first thing that had to recover was my mind getting back up for it again. Once my head was back in the game, my body would get better very quickly. So there's a huge amount of that mental aspect. And clearly, if you are, you know, a designer in a Formula One team, you don't need to be as aerobically fit as you do to be a Premiership football player. But if you approach your job as a human endeavor, then there's a level of physical fitness and there's a high level of mental fitness that you need to be in order to perform that role at a world-class level.
And what kind of offerings do you give the staff here? Because I think the gym was only open last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, so we've just built a state-of-the-art gym facility and medical center that, as you say, opened last week. We're enormously excited about that. In the first week of that being opened, then we managed to get 80% of the staff through the induction process, signed up to the app that goes with it. virtually all of the sessions that week have been fully booked.
What kind of sessions are we talking?
These are at the moment mainly physical training sessions, to be honest. But with the medical center, then we'll build out a more advanced program of other events as well.
So when you were a rower, tell us just how fit were you? I mean, were you fitter than Piastri?
Yes, I was. The truth is that rowing is a sport where the primary differentiator is physical fitness, and Formula One is a sport where the primary differentiator is driver skill. So they need a very high level of fitness to cope with 6G and braking and 4G lateral, the heat in the car, everything else. But it's not the primary differentiator. And if a F1 driver works harder, normally they'll go slower. So the rowing team are fitter than Formula One drivers. Formula One drivers are incredibly fit. I think they're often likened to Premiership football players. Rowers are likened to virtually nothing. I think only really cross-country skiers have a kind of similar level of fitness to the rowers.
What was your fitness regime, if you like, when you were... Was it just on the ergo every single day?
Through the winter, we would train three times a day most days. Those sessions were generally 90 minutes to 2 hours long. Normally, if they're in the boat, they'd normally be 20 kilometres. Normally of those... Then two would be on the water and the other would be a land training session. So that would either be an hour on the rowing machine or probably an hour and a half of weightlifting. The rest days normally would be one Sunday per month, normally the weekend after an event. One of the other things that makes rowing incredibly tough is that you take part in probably four competitions a year. So it's a real training sport. Most of the time is just head down, locked away in the pain cave training.
The pain cave.
Yeah, that's one of the challenges of Formula One, is that actually Formula One is a racing sport and they get very little time to train in the car.
Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V. The peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V. All engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V. The peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V. All engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com. What was your highest point as a rower?
I mean, obviously the Olympic silver medal in the Beijing Olympics was my biggest achievement. I did win the World Championships in the Cox 4 in Seville, but all rowers value the Olympics more highly than the World Championships. If I'm honest, the highest point was winning the heat in Beijing. In the heat, we were brilliant. And we won our heat by clear water. And that was the best we rode. And actually, in the final, we were unable to produce that performance. And the Canadians, who'd won the other heat, were able to beat us.
So, peak too soon in the Olympics. I mean, that's actually quite an interesting example of what lessons did you learn in that Olympic experience, maybe that you can transfer to working with Oscar and McLaren now?
I mean, one of the interesting things with the Olympics is the level of focus that comes from having one opportunity in 4 years. Most of the time in Formula One, then if this weekend goes badly, there's another one in 2 weeks' time. So we'll get the chance to put it right. The thing that I would liken to an Olympic level of pressure is when you go into the last race and you're level on points for the championship. And that opportunity comes, you know, maybe once in a career. And so I think that the Olympics has given me a lot of tools for dealing with what people would see as intense pressure and kind of taking that in my stride because I've done it before.
And for those people who don't know about rowing, at the Olympics, you were in an eight. How important is teamwork when you're in an eight?
To be honest, an eight is all about teamwork. We have an expression in rowing about an eight being greater than the sum of its parts and that being the aim. One of the nice things about rowing is that you can't play your weakest person out of the game. Like in football, quite often a team will win with 10 people on the team because someone's been sent off, someone didn't turn up because they were ill, you could still win. In rowing, if one person checks out, then it's game over and, you know, seven will never beat eight. So you're only really as good as your weakest man. You have to build each other up together to get the best outcome, which I found incredibly fulfilling. That was, to be honest, my favorite bit about rowing was the teamwork and working together. And an outcome of that is that those people have remained incredibly close friends, even nearly 20 years on now.
And does your side of the garage at a Formula One race, do you feel that you are pulling all in the same direction and somehow what you learned in rowing is being used now in Formula One?
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to think so. I think that building strong teams was one of my strengths in rowing. And I think that generally speaking, that's been the case at McLaren as well. I think that the people I work with generally, touch wood, like working with me. So building that team, I think, is important. I think that goes beyond just side of the garage, though. The garage is pretty unified, and I would be disappointed to learn that that was specific to one side of the garage.
You worked with Jürgen Grobler. We're talking about rowing again, just who was, I think, the most successful coach in Olympic history. He's got a phenomenal record. What did you learn from him that you can apply now in Formula One and particularly in your role as Director of Human Performance?
Jürgen won gold medals at every Olympics from 76 till 2016. And that despite not having been a particularly successful athlete himself. He rode at a high level, but not a very high level really, compared to winning a gold medal at that many games. And so I've spent a lot of time as someone who's made a career in elite sport, kind of analysing and considering what he was so good at. And I think two things stand out. One is he was not really sentimental and he valued every gold medal equally. So never would Jürgen say, oh, I said I wanted to win the pair, so we need to stick at the pair. If he felt that the gold medal would come more readily in the Coxless 4, he would switch and the whole team would be turned on its head to move the focus to the Coxless 4 because a gold was a gold in his eyes. And I think it takes a lot of strength to take that sentimentality out of it. You know, if you set yourself a target, humans tend to think, I want to achieve that target. The reality is, when we look back at that string of gold medals, no one knows which boat he targeted. They just know that his boat won.
Hearing you talk about Jürgen, I think you could be talking about Andrea Stella as well. Is that a fair comparison? The lack of sentimentality. He just wants to win, doesn't care who it is.
Yes, I think that is fair. Andrea has that as well. And I think that is a real strength if you can take personality and personal aims out of it and just look at actually what's the big picture, what are we trying to achieve, how do we best achieve that. So I'd say that is a trait which is true for both of them.
So Tom, it's 2008. You've just won the silver medal in Beijing at the Olympic Games. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, you'd already made up your mind that that was going to be your last Olympics. So why Formula One? Why McLaren? Why race engineering? Just tell us about this, what seems, at least from the outside, to be a massive step into the unknown from rowing to Formula One.
I've always been fascinated by sport. I'd studied engineering at Cambridge. And I loved engineering. And I always liked the kind of technical side of the sports I'd been involved with. In rowing, it's not such a technical sport from an equipment point of view as Formula One, but still the boats are, you know, they're carbon fiber boats and there's a degree of aerodynamics and hydrodynamics and that sort of thing involved, all of which I'd found fascinating. So I basically wanted to try and find a career that allowed me to merge the two. And I think if you say to someone, I'm looking for a career that merges engineering and sport, then F1 is the first thing you think of. There are other examples. I mean, the America's Cup's on at the moment, which is a perfect example. But that was really what attracted me to it. I have always had a thing for cars. I built cars when I was younger. My first car was a Mini that I did a load of work on. I built a Cobra replica. So I'm not going to claim that I have no interest in cars. But really, it was the crossover between engineering and elite sport that appealed to me.
How did you find Cambridge, if I can just take you back to that? Because when James Allison was on the podcast, James being the technical chief at Mercedes, he said, I've never been more academically stimulated than when I was at Cambridge. Nothing in Formula One has come close. Can you relate to that?
No. When I was at Cambridge, the thing I was acutely aware of, that was the first time in my life that I realized there were a lot of people who were a lot cleverer than I was. And, you know, through school, I'd always been top set and fairly comfortable, let's say, academically. And then I went to Cambridge and I was like, wow, there are some people who can just take in information, which to me is complete, like it's so far out there, it's nonsense. And so in that way, yes, I guess academically challenged. But the truth is, I kind of found my way through Cambridge. And to some extent, some of those challenges I got through rather than really embraced. I was rowing a lot. And so there were bits of it that I found absolutely fascinating. But I found working in Formula One, and particularly as the race engineer, you're the translator between the technical department and the driver. So you have to understand stuff well enough to distill it into a language that the drivers can understand. And people have a job of explaining that to you, which is a great position to be in. So I've found the kind of academic pace and development of working in Formula One has really suited me, and so I'm not sure I share James's view on it.
You say you're the translator between the driver and the technical department. Would you be a better race engineer if you'd raced yourself, been a racing driver yourself?
I'm not sure that's true. I think it's difficult because I haven't been a racing driver myself. Like, my job isn't to be able to drive the car, it's to explain to Oscar how to drive the car. And a lot of that teaching process isn't actually about explaining to Oscar how to drive the car. It's about creating a situation where Oscar figures out himself how to drive the car. A lot of teaching people focus too much on, and coaching, they focus too much on being right. And the reality is, very often the best way to teach something is to deliberately be wrong, such that the driver or the pupil figures out what correct looks like. So sometimes it's just a matter of suggestion and of highlighting a way of approaching something or a way of looking at a problem. But I think always, like, the idea of my conversations with Oscar is that he leaves with a plan of what his actions are going to be like. And quite often that might be, I'm planning to brake 0.02 of a second later before this corner, which is not really even a plan that has to be subconscious, that has to be so deeply ingrained that it's pretty much subconscious. In order to do that, fundamentally, is much better if he thinks it's his idea. So my job is to kind of take him to a place where he has got a plan of how to drive the car that's going to work.
What is the catalyst for that conversation? Is it you looking at the data and comparing what Oscar's doing to Lando Norris and seeing maybe that Lando is braking a little bit later into turn three? So you're trying to encourage Oscar to do the same? Is that where it all starts?
That's where it all starts, because that's the easy way to do it. And one of the challenges that we always set ourselves is to be able to do it. You know, what are you going to do if Lando, you know, has a car problem at the start of the day and we can't fix his car to get him back out? It's not okay to then say, oh, I was braking 20 meters early for turn three all day because Lando wasn't driving. So we very much set ourselves the target of trying to get the best out of Oscar independently of a teammate. And actually, one of the most impressive things Oscar did the first time he worked with the team, he drove the simulator. And they had a problem with the simulator that meant the lap delta wasn't working. The lap delta is the number on the dash that tells him how fast he's doing relative to his best lap. Within less than 10 laps, he was matching the lap times of our race drivers, matching all the breakpoints. He just dialed all that in himself, no feedback, incredibly quickly. And he has that ability to figure all that stuff out himself. So often as the race engineer, one of your jobs is to not mess him up. You know, you don't want to be, if you say too much, you can just create noise in the guy's head. And that's true of any driver, not just Oscar. So the driver themselves have a process of improving and developing and testing things. And really what you want to do is to kind of support that. And that's a bit what I mean when I say it's about creating an environment where he has the right idea of what to do in his head rather than creating an environment where I was right and I told him to do something, but he didn't believe it, so he didn't really do it.
Tom, what's your attitude to data? Because what is it? The cars have, is it 300 sensors, 4,000 channels? Do you think there's too much data out there?
No, I don't.
That's with your engineering head on, I guess. Imagine there was no data, there was a ban on data. How would that change your day-to-day trackside?
I think if there was a complete ban on data, it would change it a lot. If there was a ban on the telemetry, the live data coming back from the car, it actually wouldn't change that much. It would just mean that we had to work even harder in between the sessions, let's say. The complete ban on data would change things a lot because you can't learn that much from a video. And it would move to a situation more where you relied on the feedback of the driver to adjust the car. The truth is, we would almost never have a complete ban of data in that we would still be simulating things in the background, even if they were unrelated to the car. You can't unlearn what you've learned. So it's almost an unimaginable situation in Formula One now. And it's interesting, I mean, with my rowing hat on, it's interesting to compare the way Formula One relies on data almost exclusively because the cars are so fast that videoing them in a way that allows you to really see what's going on is very challenging. And a lot of the movements are very small. The pedals, for example, are completely hidden. So when you watch Formula One on TV, it's very difficult to understand what the drivers are doing with their feet, even though you can see what they're doing with their hands. Best example of that is Jensen. Jensen Button, everyone always said, was the smoothest driver in the world because they couldn't see what his feet were doing. But he drove like a duck, and his feet under the surface of the water were doing all kinds of things to keep the car balanced such that he could be smooth with his hands. So I think that effectively all sport people use data. It just depends on what the data in question is. It might be that that is sitting in a launch, following a boat, watching the boat, or even from a bike on the bank, watching the boat row past. It might be that that is 4,000 data channels coming back from a Formula One car. It's almost unimaginable to approach sport in a way that has no data. You might say no wiggly lines, but we would just find a different source of data to tell us what we were interested in looking at.
Interesting that you mentioned Jensen, because I did want to ask you about how experience changes a driver, in that Jensen, what he did more than 300 Grand Prix. He was already a world champion when you started working with him. How does experience make a driver better? And was Jensen still learning stuff when you started working with him?
He was definitely still learning stuff. The experience, I think, makes a driver better because they are better equipped to deal with different situations. I mean, a perfect example with Jensen is his ability to read conditions, judge what tyre he should be on, get the best out of kind of changeable conditions was phenomenal. And many of his greatest wins were in those kinds of changeable conditions. Really, that sort of thing comes from experience. I think the other aspect that comes from experience is one of the great myths around Formula One is that different drivers like different kinds of car. The truth is, every driver, their ideal car is the same. And what they're looking for is the same. What varies is what they hate and what really trips them up. And the bigger you can make your sort of operating window of like, oh, I can cope with this, I can cope with this and still be really quick, then the better you do. And so some of that comes with experience. And then the last thing I'd say that really comes with experience is the tires on a Formula One car are incredibly complicated. They are, I mean, they look like just a big block of rubber, but they are operating at, you know, at times well over 100 degrees. They're sticky. The surface of the rubber is almost molten and moving around. The shear through the rubber, if you think of a car which is pulling 6G, and you think of all of that force is just going through the rubber in the tire, then the shear in the rubber is incredible. That's generating massive amounts of temperature. So the tires are just trying to pull themselves apart. And understanding how to get the maximum grip out of, you know, we often joke about them being a black box, the tire, understanding how to get the maximum grip out of that, exploit it over a lap in qualifying, over a stint in the race, kind of being able to predict that and adapt to that quickly, I think is primarily experience. It's very difficult to teach that in a classroom before someone's driven an F1 car.
And is that feel for grip on the limit that you're alluding to there, is that the difference between the great and the good? Because I look at this year's Red Bull, it seems Max Verstappen is the only one who can drive that car effectively. If you wind the clock back to the mid-90s, Michael Schumacher seemed to be the only one who could drive the Benettons. All his teammates, great drivers, just couldn't get close to him. That's all about feel, is it?
I mean, I'm not really qualified to talk about Red Bull or Benetton.
No, sure. But when you have one driver that's so dominant in a team,
I think normally when you have one driver who's so dominant in a team, it's because the car is in a window that, or the car has some characteristics that the other driver really struggles to cope with. And if you can improve those characteristics, you will reduce the deficit between the drivers. You won't necessarily eliminate it. And often what will happen is that the conditions will then unpick the less skillful driver, or the requirement to do a much longer stint than was originally planned, or whatever it may be. So you never fully close the gap. But I think that some drivers have a very broad window in which they're happy that they can get the best out of the car and they can shape the car around them. And other drivers struggle to adapt to those limitations of a car, even though they may be brilliant with other limitations from a car.
Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
Can we talk about youth now, particularly Oscar? But why do you feel the young guns are so ready to go when they arrive in Formula One? I mean, look at what Oscar did last year. Look at what Ollie Bearman has done this year. Even Franco Colapinto in the Williams. I mean, they've just hit the ground running the first time they drive these cars. Why do you think it's the case? Is there something in Formula Two that is just preparing the drivers so well, or is it more than that?
What you say is true. The young guns who've arrived have been very impressive. But if you look back at, you know, when Lewis joined Formula One, that was not so different.
But Tom, he did, I think, 10,000 Ks of testing over the winter, 2.6 to 2.7. And he'd done 2 years in Formula 3 and 1 year in GP2. I feel like Lewis's ramp up to Formula 1 was smoother, whereas these guys are coming from, some of them, relative obscurity, sort of mid-grid Formula 2, and bam, getting the results in F1.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, they've been very impressive. What Colapinto's done in the Williams, I think, has far outstripped what anyone expected of him. But the thing, I don't really know anything about Franco, to be honest, other than having seen his results in a few races. But looking at Oscar's kind of car control coming into Formula One was phenomenal on day one. So I can imagine that some of these other drivers have a similar characteristic to that. What Oscar's had to learn a lot, as I said, is the stuff that comes with the experience of, I felt these tyres at this kind of circuit. I felt these tyres at this kind of circuit. There were certain circuits in Oscar's first year where he was immediately incredibly good. And I think Saudi Arabia was probably an easy example to pick for that. I think that was race two last year. And he had what would have been a great weekend apart from an accident on the first lap. But he qualified very well. He was in Q3. The car at the time was, you know, not necessarily worthy of Q3, or not consistently. But he was really strong at that circuit straight away. There were other circuits where his lack of experience, which became a lack of knowing how to get the best out of the cars and the tyre, came unstuck. And I think that's what you'll tend to see with the rookies coming in, is that they have some phenomenal weekends and some poor weekends, which potentially go unnoticed because expectation wasn't that high.
And the simulator can't replicate the tyre situation at a Grand Prix.
Ultimately, at the moment, I think the short answer is no. Obviously, we're a Formula One team and we're working on that pretty hard to get closer to that and improve that. We can capture a qualifying lap pretty accurately, but capturing a 20-lap run where the tyres get a little bit worse every lap and the amount they get worse is a reaction to what happened the previous lap, that is very challenging to do because the tyre is such a complicated thing to model.
I don't mean to be negative about your sim, because if there's one observation from the outside looking in at McLaren, certainly this year, is that you guys arrive at a Grand Prix very ready to go, and then the others seem to catch up, if they do at all. Not the case in Singapore, but they do seem to catch up over the weekend with more running. So it would appear that your sim work pre-weekend may be better than anyone else's.
I think, like, one of the things we pride ourselves on is preparation. This is Formula One, so everyone is doing a lot of preparation. But I think we arrive at a weekend having done a lot of preparation. And generally, when weekends don't go well and we unpick why, we attribute in the end that it's a lack of preparation, be that strategic preparation, setup preparation, driving preparation, whatever it might be. So we pride ourselves on doing a lot of prep. And I would like to think that trend is because we really hit the ground running in free practice one, where others potentially make more changes and have to adapt things more through the weekend, and then normally get themselves into a reasonable place by qualifying, because, as I said, this is Formula One and we shouldn't underestimate how good the competitors are. You know, for a long time, Mercedes looked completely unbreakable in Formula One, and then for a long time, Red Bull, and in particular Max, looked like he literally couldn't do anything wrong. So to be able to put yourselves ahead of them ever is, something to be proud of.
Final one on the topic of Oscar. Does he have what it takes to become world champion?
Yes, I think he does. I think, I really hate, one of the things people talk about in Formula One is future world champion, which I think is absolute nonsense, because so many stars have to align for that to happen. What you can look at is the rate at which someone's improving. And Oscar is improving at a phenomenal rate and has maintained that rate for nearly two seasons now. So at some point in a career, that rate of improvement for most people levels off. I think for everybody previously, that levels off. And so the question is, where does that level off? I would say, at the moment, he's improving at a fantastic rate. I think Lando is a incredibly tough benchmark to be up against as your teammate, or up with as your teammate, probably I should say. And Oscar is, you know, doing a good job of keeping Lando, well, keeping Lando honest, let's say. So I think all the while he keeps improving, then the sky's the limit. And absolutely, I think he has what it takes, but it takes an army as well. Like, it's, you know, Formula One is not really an individual sport. And so it relies on him being able to get himself into a place, to build a team around himself, to be part of a team being built around himself to support that. And one of the things, you know, when we spoke previously, Tom, one of the things I spoke about is for a driver to be world champion, that they also need to be a leader within the team. It's a strange environment in F1 because most of the leaders within the team have done 30 years in F1 and they're now in their 40s. The driver comes in aged 21, 22, and you say, oh, by the way, you're now a leader in this team of 800 of, you know, the top engineers and mechanics in the world. And go on, off you go and be a leader with very little, you know, this is just some guy who got in a go-kart when they were a kid and drove it around in circles. And now suddenly you're leading an organization of 1,000 people.
How's he coping with that?
I think that is an area where he is coping phenomenally well. And his kind of down-to-earth but still humorous attitude is well received in the team. He makes time for people. Oscar has a very personal relationship with the team. He knows a huge number of people in the team by name and knows like personal details about them. So that is quite galvanizing. It makes people support him more than just support him as a, like, oh, this is the guy driving for us at the moment. It makes people kind of genuinely get behind him and move heaven and earth to support him. So he's, you know, he's really grown into that. He was good at it on day one, but that's something that's really developed as well.
So the team is sitting pretty in the Constructors' Championship. Lando is the one closest to Max Verstappen in the Drivers' Championship. If it requires Oscar to give up a win to help Lando in his pursuit of the Drivers' World Championship, how do you think that would affect Oscar? You're a competitor. You've been there. You're a sportsman in your own right.
So I think there's two aspects to that. The first is that this team is really tight. And this team wants the best for the team. I know you said we're sitting pretty in the Constructors' Championship. It never feels like that on the inside. You know, as I said before about some of the competitor cars, I mentioned Mercedes and Red Bull, but Ferrari looked like a pretty significant challenge in the Constructors' Championship as well. So we've got a lot of work to do just to sew that up. The Drivers' Championship, then Lando is the closest driver to Max on points and is our, therefore, at the moment, our best chance of catching him. And obviously, as a team, we want to win both. And the team includes both drivers. The other thing I would say is that if you're a driver who thinks you're going to win drivers' championships, you want to be in a team that will support you to do that. And so if you are not prepared to help the team achieve that when it's the other guy, how do you expect the team to treat you when it's you the next time? So not that there has to be a tit for tat within that, but simply that there have been plenty of examples of Formula One teams where the two drivers just rip strips off each other for the whole season, and then at the end of it, Kimi Raikkonen wins. I think that from that point of view, Oscar has been very, very positive in his support for the team and willingness to support the team in what needs to happen.
He's looking at the long game.
He's looking at the long game, and genuinely, he wants his team to win.
Can we talk about a couple of other drivers you've worked with? Daniel Ricciardo is a hot topic at the minute, of course. He's going to be much missed in Formula One. How do you reflect on your time working with Daniel here at McLaren?
I mean, working with Daniel was great because he's just a really lovely guy. He's a really positive guy to be around. I think it's, you know, it's well known that we didn't achieve what we wanted to achieve with him at McLaren.
But there were peaks, you know, Monza. Absolutely. 21, obviously. Why wasn't he able to reproduce those performances more often?
There were times when he kind of was able to get on top of the car, able to drive the car how he needed, able to get the best out of it. And that weekend in Monza, he was you know, pretty faultless all weekend. It was a sprint weekend. He qualified well. We moved forwards in the sprint. We were able to take the lead off the launch at the race start. And then, although Max and Lewis ultimately took themselves out in the race, we had them both covered, and Daniel would have won anyway. So there were some really high peaks. And that one was, you know, our first win for almost 10 years. That felt absolutely huge. But there were other weekends that didn't go so well. I think that the car we had needed a different sort of driving to the cars he'd been successful in previously. And he struggled to adapt what he was doing to get the best out of that. Obviously, he stopped working here and went to AlphaTauri. And again, my impression from the outside was that his time there was similar. There were some very good days when they achieved what they'd been hoping to achieve in that team, and other days when it didn't work as well. So I think the main thing is that Daniel, when he was here, was always really positive, always really supportive with the team. And everyone who worked directly with him, you know, loved working with him. And so it was tough on us as well that between all of us, we weren't able to achieve what we wanted to achieve together.
Did you see the quote from Christian Horner middle of last year where he said he reckoned Daniel had picked up some bad habits here at McLaren and they were trying to iron them out on the simulator in Milton Keynes at Red Bull? What's your take on that?
I disagree.
Was he doing anything that you thought was odd in the way he was driving the car?
No, I would say actually that Daniel was driving the car very normally. And if anything, our car required some quite specific actions with the primarily around the turn-in phase of the corner, which he struggled to adapt to because they require very, very precise timing from the driver. And you have to do that quite ballistically, very, very quickly. There were other corner types that didn't require such a sharp input that Daniel's approach worked very well. And if anything, Lando learned from Daniel in those. So I don't think he did leave the team with bad habits. He learned the team having adapted his driving in a certain way to try and get the best out of our car. And then clearly, at the time at least, the Red Bull felt like they needed something else. My impression is that that is not so much bad habits as just like, I've got one approach now, I'm trying to adapt to another car and just a different way of driving.
Final driver I'd like to ask you about, Carlos Sainz. Now, we had Williams team principal James Vowles on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he says that he thinks in Carlos and Alex Albon, Williams have the best driver lineup in Formula One in 2025. I don't want to get into that necessarily, but I would love your opinion on what Williams are getting in Carlos Sainz. What kind of a driver is he?
Carlos is a brilliant driver to work with. Carlos once said to me that when we asked him what his ideal job in Formula One was, he said race engineer before he considered whether driver was an option. And he loves the engineering and the technical side of Formula One. And you know, it makes sense because his dad, Carlos Sr., is the same in rally. So I think they are getting someone who will really want to engage with their technical department, who will want to, you know, join engineering meetings and help them be pushing in the right direction. He absolutely loves all that. Carlos is probably, of all the drivers I've worked with, the one I've stayed closest friends with when I stopped working directly with them. He's a really easygoing, nice guy to deal with. He's, you know, kind of demanding when he needs to be demanding. You actually want to work with someone who's demanding when things need to be demanding. But he's funny. He's a bit wacky. He's definitely going to be a big asset to the Williams team, and I think we'll help them a lot.
Another thing James said is that Carlos has improved every team he's raced for. Would you agree with that?
Certainly, he improved McLaren. He was brilliant at McLaren. He joined, I think, when he joined McLaren, you know, he'd been dropped by Renault as it was at the time. And his stock in Formula One, to be honest, wasn't that high. And I think that he helped McLaren improve a lot at the time when we really needed that. And I think that we set him back on his feet and, you know, positioned him correctly as one of the top drivers in Formula One. So I think that is true. I think he's clearly helped Ferrari as well. And, you know, genuinely, I'd say they're a very realistic challenge in the Constructors' Championship at the moment, and no small part of that should sit with him. So I think that probably is very much harder for me to talk about the kind of AlphaTauri Renault days when, to be honest, I didn't follow him that closely until he arrived at McLaren, and I was like, oh, it turns out he's pretty good.
So he's still a mate. You clearly have to form a very close bond with the drivers you're working with. What are the non-negotiables for you when it comes to establishing that relationship? What are you looking for from a driver?
The thing in that relationship that you want to be able to do is to read what they're thinking and what their mindset is on as few words as possible. Because when you're talking on the radio in the race, they don't say a lot. And so a lot of what we do effectively is reading between the lines. And quite often that works both ways. Sometimes the driver will ask a question and we're not in a position to give a complete answer as you would do in private. So building that relationship such that you know what each other are talking about, you know when something is said in a one arm tied behind the back kind of way, you can pick up the frustration in a driver's voice, even though he knows that conveying that isn't helpful. That is the key part of the relationship, because during the race engineer, you're literally the voice inside the guy's head. So being able to, if you like, read his mind and give him the key piece of information he needs immediately before he realizes he needs it, that's the aim.
Well, Tom, it has been brilliant to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time. When this show comes out, we're going to be touching down in Austin. 6 races to go. What's the excitement level within McLaren about what's to come?
I mean, massive excitement, because there's a lot on the table for us. I think that we have impressed even ourselves that we've got ourselves this close going into the last 6 races. We knew we were on a good trajectory. We knew the team was in a good place. But the competitive position is maybe a nice surprise, let's say. I think we go in with a lot of confidence, with still a sort of underdog, like a 1-point underdog feeling within the team. I'm not sure how much that's shared externally or not, but I think certainly in the driver championship, that's a reasonable description. And in the constructors championship, as I said, the Ferrari team look very strong. They've had some great races. Their race pace is always good. So I think that's far from a given. And you know, one of the exciting things in Formula One is that, and is one of the things that makes sport great, is that it can be incredibly cruel. And you can have a, you know, what looks like a shoe-in becomes completely unravels because of one small bolt that undoes during the race or whatever it may be. So we need to stay on top of the reliability of the cars, the kind of strategic delivery. There's quite a lot to get right between now and the end of the season, but with so much at stake, it's a really exciting time.
So much at stake. And what would it mean for you personally to win the Constructors' title with this team? The first time they would have won it since 1998.
I mean, I've been at the team since 2008. When you asked about leaving rowing and coming to Formula One, I had a 2-week break in between the Olympics and putting on a suit to join McLaren. And we won the Drivers' Championship that year. But actually, it was 2 months after I joined the team. It was almost too soon for me to feel like I was genuinely a part of it. I was my mood at the time was really happy for my new friends rather than feeling like I had been part of us winning the Drivers' Championship. So this would be the first time that it would feel like it was something that I'd been a big part of creating. I mean, I say a big part, a 1/800th, let's say, of creating. So that will be really special. And there have been periods in that 16-year nearly history that I've been in the team where this has looked incredibly far away. And I think particularly from the outside, it's looked incredibly far away. And you know, we've been into qualifying sessions where the dream was to try and get one car out of Q1. As a team, we've kind of stayed together through all that and fought through all that. And things have developed and improved and we've picked up momentum. And so it would feel incredibly special if we can deliver that.
Can we end this just what I call the traditional way? We have some quick fire questions. First one, what else are you good at?
Rowing. Yeah. The reason why I'm good at this and rowing is just like blind determination. I just keep going. Big diesel engine, just keep going, keep pushing.
does that transfer into other sports though as well? Is there something else? Like, do you cycle?
I try not to. I'm rubbish at sports that require eye-hand coordination. Anything with catching or hitting involved is a total disaster. But sports like sailing, windsurfing, skiing, which are primarily muscle memory and balance, then I'm quite good at those.
Which racing person, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
I'm not sure I want to be stuck in a lift.
You're an engineer. You can mend the lift. But you imagine you've got a good half hour to chat to someone.
I don't think I have a good answer to that because I don't really think about sport in that way. And I don't particularly have heroes. You know, I'm very kind of forward facing in that regard. So I'm not sure I have an answer to that.
Who would play you in a film?
Jason Statham, apparently.
Yes, that's very good. That's one of the best answers we've had for that. Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
Who is the coolest person in my contacts? One of the drivers I've worked with previously, I imagine. I'm not sure I have anyone else particularly cool in my contacts who's cool outside of F1. I want a more eclectic answer, but I don't think I have one.
Can you name that driver?
Ah, Pedro de la Rosa. Pedro's a total legend, king of Spain.
Great racing driver too. Were you working with him?
So when I joined the team, he was in the simulator team. He was one of our simulator drivers. He stopped racing for McLaren by then, but he was one of our simulator drivers. And I learned a hell of a lot from Pedro, but he's just a really lovely guy. So I'm going to go with Pedro.
Okay. Look, final one. If you hosted a podcast like this, who would be your first guest?
Do you know, I think Ron Dennis would make a great podcast guest. You need to try and get him on.
Oh, believe me, I'm trying. Is there anything you'd want to ask Ron?
Not particularly, but I guess I'd be interested. Like Ron has really, you know, when he left McLaren, one of his big things was I was just a chapter in the book. And he has had incredible closure from it. So he's really not been around at all. So I'd be fascinated to kind of see how he sees McLaren now, because it's very different now as a team, both internally and externally from when he was in it. And I'd be fascinated to see his impression, good and bad, of what's changed.
Tom, what a great chat. Thank you very much for your time.
Cool. Thanks, Tom.
Tom Stallard, Jason Statham. Yes, I can see a likeness. And I wonder if Tom knows that Yuki Tsunoda is a massive Jason Statham fan. Now, that could get confusing if they ever worked together, couldn't it? But what a fascinating chat. Tom's previous experience as an Olympian gives him a unique perspective on Formula One, which can only benefit Oscar Piastri and McLaren as a whole. Tom, many thanks for your time, and I'll see you again in Austin at the US Grand Prix. Well, what did you learn from this chat with Tom? Please let me know through all the usual means. I'm at TomClarksonF1, or you can use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Which, of course, is my segue into what you sent in about last week's show with Gunter Steiner. Gunter's always forthright in his opinions, and it was fun to catch up with him again. And I thought this message from Kat Chevry summed up what many of us were thinking. "I just love listening to Gunter," she says. "Great accent, insightful, funny, he's got it all." He certainly has, Kat, and thanks for getting in touch. Well, that's almost it for this episode. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. Don't forget to check out F1's other podcasts. On F1 Nation, I'm joined by VCARB returnee Liam Lawson to preview the US Grand Prix at Austin. And the latest F1 Explains answers your questions about downforce. You can hear both of those shows right here on your podcast app. Well, thank you very much for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One
and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.